and welcome back to another season of Off the Deaton Path. My name is Stan Deaton with the Georgia Historical Society, and we welcome you to this podcast for the week of July 15th, 2019. This week I have a very special guest on the podcast, one of the last living combat veterans of World War II. This Sunday, July 21st, marks the 75th anniversary of the invasion of Guam, a turning point in the war in the Pacific that led to ultimate victory over Japan. Guam is part of the Marianas Islands, stretching 400 miles from Guam northward to Iwo Jima. The other islands in the Marianas are Saipan and Tinian. The other main islands, I should say. The plan to capture the Marianas was one of the most ambitious in the history of amphibious warfare, with 500 ships carrying approximately 125,000 troops, and they were 3,500 miles from their base of operations in Pearl Harbor and 1,000 miles from Eniwetok. Taking Saipan allowed the United States to establish air bases for B-29 heavy bombers, which had been developed for the specific purpose of bombing Japan. And the two planes that dropped atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki left from Tinian in August 1945. My guest today was part of that invasion of Guam 75 years ago. Fred Mingledorf was born in 1924 in Savannah 95 years ago and grew up in Hinesville. In 1941, he enrolled in North Georgia College in Dahlonega. He enlisted in the United States Marine Corps in August 1943. He took part in the campaign for the Marshall Islands, particularly on Roy and Namur, two islands attached by a causeway, part of the Kwajalein Atoll, the first of the Marshall Islands captured by U.S. troops in World War II. Then on July 21, 1944, Fred took part in the invasion of Guam with Company A, 4th Amphibian Tractor Battalion, 3rd Amphibious Corps. While in Guam, Fred contracted malaria and dysentery, sending him to a hospital ship while the rest of his unit eventually went on to Iwo Jima. He was discharged in March 1945 and returned to Savannah. The Frederick William Mingledorf Jr. family papers are now held at the Georgia Historical Society, including Fred's memorabilia from his tour of duty in the Pacific in World War II. I sat down with Fred to talk about his experience in the war on this 75th anniversary of the invasion of Guam at the Jepson House Education Center in Savannah on July 17th, 2019. I hope you enjoy it. Fred Mingledorf, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you.
You are a combat veteran of World War II, of which there are not many left. I want to start with that. You are 95 years old. You were born on April 13th, 1924.
24.
In Savannah.
Right.
I know you grew up in Hinesville. We'll talk about that. But the thing I want to start with first is a statistic. There were roughly 16 million Americans who served in World War II. And of those, a little less than 400,000 remain, about 2.5%. When you hear statistics like that, what do you think?
Well, I know I'm not here very long. My time's coming one of these days.
Statistically, that would seem to be true, right?
Yes, sir.
But really, you're one of the few, not just World War II veterans walking around, but you're really one of the few combat veterans. I know that you don't call yourself a hero. That's for other people to do. And you would probably say you served with heroes. But there just aren't many World War II veterans who have made it this long. I want to talk about your experience in the war, your experience after the war, your experience being a veteran of a conflict that is receding into the past, and yet you are a living, tangible reminder of a very dark period in history. And just get your thoughts about that.
Well, I don't feel that, I don't think about the service very much. I found that when I returned from the war that I decided I would try to think about other things and do other things. And that was good for me. That's how I adjusted to being in the service.
Mm. So let's start at the beginning. Your father was a World War I veteran.
Correct.
What was his name?
Fred Mingledorf, Sr.
Okay. And you had how many siblings?
How many?
Siblings did you have?
One.
One, okay.
One brother.
Younger?
Younger, 11 years younger.
What was your father's experience in the First World War? Do you know?
My father never talked about it. He was in France and fought in France, but he never talked about it. My uncle was in the same outfit with my father, and they never talked about it.
What branch of the service was he in?
He was in the Army.
Okay. And I know that he left you some artifacts because I think you've given those to the Georgia Historical Society.
Yeah, that's something he sent my mother, and she gave me. When she gave me the letters I had written her when I was overseas, she kept them. She gave me those.
Okay. Did he live long enough to see you serve in the Second World War?
He certainly did. Yes, okay. He did.
Did he ever talk to you about it, or did you ever try talking with him about
no.
it when you came back?
No.
You had shared this experience.
It's very peculiar, but most of us, when we came back from the service, we just didn't talk about it. We all got along so much better if we didn't.
That's interesting. So he never talked to you about what he did, what he saw, what he experienced?
Never said, never told me anything.
You grew up in Hinesville.
Yes.
And I heard you speaking about this a minute ago, but it sounded like it was a pretty, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounded like a pretty idealistic growing up. I mean, is that how you would describe it?
Yes, it was nice. I lived in the country, so to speak. Hinesville, very small town. And it was just a good, healthy environment for a young person.
And where did you go to high school?
In Hinesville.
Class of?
1941.
So you graduated before the attack on Pearl Harbor.
Yes, I did. I was in college when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor.
Okay. And where were you in school, at college?
I was in college at North Georgia College in Dahlonega.
Right. Okay. Did you have the military training there?
That's why they sent me there. My father realized we were going to have a war, and he sent me to North Georgia College so I could get some military training
and some
discipline.
Did you need that?
I imagine so.
Did you like the military training? Did you take to it?
Yes, I liked it. It was all right. Good for me.
And I think you transferred to Furman University in 1942. Now, why was that? Why did you transfer?
Because I thought I could get a better education at Furman than I could at North Georgia College.
What were you studying?
Just general subjects.
Okay.
Nothing in particular.
Okay.
Georgia history, you know.
Mm-hmm. And you joined the Marine Corps August 23rd, 1943. Is that correct?
Correct.
Now, why did you tell me? Walk me through that process. Why did you? Why did you join the Marines?
Well, I was raised in an Army town, and I don't know. I just decided I wanted to be a Marine. I don't know why, and I just decided that's what I wanted to do, and so I joined.
And so, what happened? Where did you go? Where did you train? Where did they send
you? I went
to
Atlanta, and they didn't train me at San Diego, at Parris Island, like most Marines are trained, but they sent me to California because they knew I was going overseas. And I took my boot camp at San Diego.
And what was that like?
Well, it's pretty rough because they were trying to get me straightened out.
And did they?
Yes, sir.
How long was boot camp? Longer than the Army's, I think, at that time.
Pardon?
I think it's longer than the Army at that time.
I think it was 11 weeks. I don't know.
Okay.
I can't remember. It was a long time.
Anything in particular about it that you remember from boot camp? Anything stand out in your mind?
I'd rather not say.
It was that good, huh?
Well, I had a lot of fanny kicking, and I used the fanny.
Did you meet, it's the first time, I guess, you'd really been away from home for any that far.
Correct.
Yeah. What was that like?
It was different, but I adjusted pretty well. I mean, I didn't panic or anything. I was satisfied with what I was doing. I'd had that military training at North Georgia College, which gave me some discipline.
Mm-hmm.
I needed a lot.
You met people, I'm assuming, from all over the country.
Right.
There, really, for the first time. Did you, right. Did you feel out of place at all? Did you feel like you belonged?
No, had no problem with Justin.
Okay. Did you consider yourself a country boy?
Still do.
Did you know when you joined the Marine Corps that you would be going into the Pacific?
Yes, sir. When I joined the Marine Corps, the sergeant that signed me up was named Leo, and he told me, he said, son, if you join the Marine Corps, I can have you in combat within 6 months. And I said, that's what I want.
Really?
I didn't know what I was saying, but that's what I said.
And was he right?
No, sir. I was in combat within about 4 or 5 months.
So he lied to you. You got there sooner than you thought. Well, tell me about it. So what happened? You go to California and you train, and then take me through the process of what happened, how you arrived in combat.
After I got out of the service, they sent me to Oceanside, California, which was across the street from Camp Matthews, where I had taken my survival training, rifle. I'd taken my training there. And they sent me across the street. I didn't know why, but that's where I went. And I stayed there for about 10 days. And one day they said, son, you ready to go? And I said, yes, sir. And they loaded me up.
And where'd you go?
Went first to Honolulu, but just to refuel and take on supplies.
And so I have, and you can correct me, that you were with Company A, 4th Amphibian Tractor Battalion, 3rd Amphibious Corps.
Correctly.
And you were attached to the 4th Marine Division.
Correct.
At first. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. So before we actually start talking about what you did in combat, do you feel like training prepared you for what you experienced?
I didn't know. I didn't know what, I didn't know what to expect.
And what did you find?
It was pretty different from what I anticipated.
Was there ever a point at which you thought, I really messed up here? I should be doing something else.
No, I decided I was there. I was going to make the best of it.
We tend to look back on these, World War II particularly, and we think about everybody being patriotic and wanting to do their part and wanting to serve. Is that true? Is that what you found with the men around you, that everybody was there because they wanted to be? They felt like they were doing something that was bigger than they were, so to speak?
I felt that everybody was for us. I mean, we didn't have the problem they had in Vietnam, where the American people didn't support them. Everybody supported us. Everybody was nice to us, and everybody understood.
Now, tell me what you did when you arrived at when you left Honolulu. Where did you go first? And tell me what you were doing.
Well, we stayed aboard an LST for quite some time. Pardon me. My outfit trained in Dunedin, Florida, and they have Carl in Dunedin. And they trained for 2 years. I had no experience. What my crew chief did would take me below deck in the LST down to where the tractors were and taught me how to drive a tractor to go through it, taught me how to mount a machine gun, how to field strip a machine gun, and taught me everything because I knew nothing. I had never ridden on an amphibious tractor. I was just thrown in that outfit because they needed one more man.
And when they told you were going to drive a tractor, what did you think?
Well, they didn't tell me I was going to drive it to start with because I wasn't qualified to drive it. Because when you drive on Carl, you have grousers on each side. And when one hits Carl, it spins a tractor, and if you don't know how to ride it, you go round and round. So I didn't drive, till later. But my crew chief let me drive his tractor. It was much later.
So tell me about the first time you drove it when it mattered.
Well, the first time I ever drove an amphibious tractor was on Guam. We'd been there about 10 or 12 days, and my crew chief was kind of tired, and he asked me, he said, "You want to take over?" And I said, "Oh, we were on land." So I did, and I drove it a little bit.
What did you do the 8 days before that?
Well, I helped whatever was necessary. We carried ammunition to the front. We carried anything they needed. We supplied the troops. And I told you about the story with the socks, didn't I?
Yes, but you can tell me.
Tell you again.
Yeah.
This outfit had the Japanese pinned down, and we were sent to where they were fighting and told to find out what they needed. Did they need what kind of supplies they needed? And this commanding officer said, "The main thing I need for my men, I want them to change their socks because they've been in them for a long time." So we went down to the harbor master and checked out where we could get socks. And we went out to a ship and picked up a load of socks and carried to this man.
Mm-hmm. So that was typical of the kind of thing that you were doing. But you were bringing men and supplies in.
Yes, anything we wanted to do. The mm-hmm. only time then, you see, when we landed, all the troops got off our tractor. We made two trips to the shore, and after that, we were doing whatever we were told. We didn't have troops on our tractor again until they decided they wanted to take the capital. Ghana, I can't remember the capital of Guam. But anyhow, they loaded a lot of troops on the tractors, and we didn't want to march in because it was, knew it was a good way from where the fighting was.
Mm.
So we carried troops again into the capital. Of course, not all the way in because they were fighting before we got there.
Did you yourself come under fire?
Yes, sir. Nothing serious, but enough.
And what did you think about that?
Well, I wanted to fire back. The main thing I wanted to do.
Did you have a rifle?
Yeah, I had a carbine. Hmm. The first thing, let's get back to the first wave we
sure.
made on Guam.
Yeah.
As soon as we were coming in, since we were in the first wave, we knew there was nothing ahead of us. No, nothing but enemy ahead of us. I enjoyed shooting that machine gun, spraying it around. Had a big time. They weren't shooting back right then. I was doing all the shooting. That was pretty good. When they start shooting back, that's whenever it gets to be a different story.
Which they did, right?
Not then.
Yeah.
But later.
Mm-hmm. So when you got into combat...
Yes, sir.
Those of us who have never experienced it, and there's a famous quote from Oliver Wendell Holmes, who served in the Civil War, and he said, "We have felt the incommunicable experience of war." So what was that like for you?
Well, it was scary. It really was. It was just a very scary experience. I can't describe it. You get a certain taste in your mouth. I guess it's a taste of fear. I don't know what it is. But when you get over that and that adrenaline runs through your system, you're all right. Takes a little time for that to take effect.
And you were how old?
19
years old.
19.
And you've carried that experience with you through the rest of your life.
I don't carry it anymore. I'm all right. I'm fortunate. I don't carry it. I haven't talked about the war since I can't remember when. So I'm all right. Don't misunderstand me. In fact, nobody really wants to hear about it anyway.
But you did carry it.
Yes, I carried it.
For how long?
I would say about a year. I hate to say this, but after the service, I went to the University of Georgia and really enjoyed myself. Managed to make C's and D's. with what I was doing, and I spent a lot of time doing other things, and got over the war.
Well, I think you'd earned it.
I was with a bunch of veterans, and we all had something in common. We'd all been in the service, and consequently, as I told you, we didn't talk about it. There was only one fellow that talked about it. He kept reminding us he was a captain. And can I tell you what I told him?
Please.
I told him, I said, I had the same rank in the Marine Corps. He said, oh, you were a captain? I said, no, I was a PFC. That shut him up.
Well, right. I want to get to your experience at Georgia, but I do want to back up. So you fought on Guam, and that was in, I believe, in the spring of 1944, early 1944. And from there, you went to Roy and Namur.
No, to Roy and Namur first.
First, okay.
See, I was very fortunate. We went to war in Roy and Namur in Marshalls.
Right.
And I was very fortunate that it was a calm landing. Every time we went to the beach with a load of people, we had no problem. It was very far. Now, don't misunderstand me. The poor people on the ground, it was different, but we didn't have any problems. They were inland enough that we had no problems with the people we landed.
But I assume you didn't know that while you were going in. You didn't know what to expect.
No.
Mm-hmm. So you went there first, and that was before Guam.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But that was part of the campaign, right, to take
the
Marshall Islands.
That was in February of 44.
Right, February. Mm-hmm.
February the 1st, I believe.
I think that's right. And that was the 4th Marine Division that you were landing there.
I had no idea.
Okay.
They didn't tell us.
It didn't matter to you, did it?
No, it didn't.
You just did your job. Right. So, right, this was part of the campaign to take the Marshall Islands, which then they moved north, obviously, in the campaign, moving toward the home islands of Japan. You got malaria on Guam.
About the 21st day, I guess. I don't know.
Okay. And what else?
I had malaria. I had dengue fever. I don't know what it is, but they say I had it. And had dysentery. And after 22 days on Guam, they evacuated me.
To where?
Believe it or not, right back to my LST I'd been on. Put me on a bunk and doctored me to some captain on the ship, did the best he could with me.
And because of that, then you missed the opportunity, if you want to call it that, to go to Iwo Jima?
Oh, you call that an opportunity? My outfit didn't do well in Iwo. Mm. A lot of them got wiped out.
Mm-hmm.
That was a terrible war.
So
terrible campaign, pardon me.
Yeah, sure. You came back after the malaria, and that was in 44. I know that you were discharged in March of 1945. What did you do between those periods?
Well, I was evacuated back to Guadalcanal, and they treated me on Guadalcanal for a while, and then they put me in a hospital there.
Mm.
And I think I was in the hospital 2 months, if I'm not mistaken. Then they evacuated me back to the States and to Camp Lejeune in North Carolina. And I was put in the hospital there, and I stayed there 2 or 3 months, and they discharged me when I got well enough to go home.
Were you ready to go at that point?
I was more than ready.
You felt like you had done what you needed to do?
I felt I had.
So I want to ask you some questions about
the
war. And so in 1945, when the war is over, you come back home, obviously. and a lot of people didn't. The people that you served with didn't.
Yes, sir.
Did you have moments of survivor's guilt?
That's why it wasn't me. Always will have that. Always wonder why I'm here and so many people aren't.
I mean, here we stand, literally 75 years after that invasion of Guam. And I'm sure at 19 years old, you probably never thought about being alive in 75 years, or maybe you did, I don't know. But what that distance in time, 75 years later, now looking back, does that seem like another lifetime, a different person, or is it still as real as closing your eyes? Can you be back there?
No. No, I'm not there. You've made me think about it, but I'm not there. Excuse me.
So what did the war do?
It matured me. It matured me. It made me love life. It's a very good teacher. I was very fortunate. I had a good gunny sergeant. A gunny sergeant, I don't know whether you know it or not, but run the company. And I mean, they run the company. And I had one that was real good. He was mean as hell, but he was fair. And all he was trying to do was help us.
What was his name?
Angelo Buffalino from Brooklyn, New York. Never forget that.
So what was he like? What can you tell me about him?
He was mean as hell, I can tell you that, but he was fair. But he was pretty, we needed it. I mean, when he said jump, we jumped. That's what we needed.
Mm.
Think about him quite often. He probably saved my life. He taught me a lot.
Mm. So when you came back to Hinesville, I'm assuming that there were a lot of other World War II veterans around. I know you said they were in Athens when you went to the university, but were there in Hinesville as well?
Well, there were about 40 of us that I knew of that came back.
Now, you carried the war with you a little while, so I'm just going to ask you questions because, again, my only experience of war is what I've seen on TV, and I've watched the Pacific, and one of the good things it did was to show what happened to some of these guys when they came back after having witnessed the horrors of war, gone through the trauma. Did you yourself have any trouble sleeping? Did you relive the war when you went to sleep at night?
Yes. I still don't want anybody to touch me while I'm asleep. I still carry that. Don't touch me while I'm asleep. I don't know what that had to do with the war, but I was never that way until after the war.
Did the problem sleeping, or did it continue, or did it fade away?
Faded away.
Mm-hmm.
I did other things.
Did you ever talk to anybody about it?
No, that's funny. We didn't talk about the war. I'm serious. That's strange. You may think that we would sit around and talk about it, but we didn't.
It's not uncommon. I mean, your generation that lived through the Great Depression and lived through World War II didn't talk about PTSD, didn't talk about depression, didn't talk about anxiety, didn't talk about what they experienced, what they saw. Was that there was just an attitude that you sort of just lived with it and got on with it, I guess, right?
Well, you always figured you were better off than the average person, and, you know. I was very thankful.
You said that there were other veterans in Hinesville. Before we were recording, you were recounting there were probably 40 other veterans in Hinesville, and only one that you knew who had what we'd call today PTSD. Who you knew that
we called it battle fatigue.
Okay,
that's the only person I knew that really had a problem.
And how did you know he had a problem?
Well, I mean, you could see he acted it out. I mean, He sometimes he wasn't there, so to speak. He had a bad problem.
Do you know where he'd been, where he'd served?
No, I don't.
Mm. Did you become active in veterans organizations?
Yes, I did.
Almost immediately?
Yes, I joined the American Legion. Oh, I think I'm celebrating, I don't know how many years, but I joined the American Legion just as soon as I got back.
So even though you didn't talk about your experiences together, I guess because you all felt like you had done the same thing, so what was the point of talking about it, but you enjoyed the company of other people who had served. So Fred Mingledorf, as a young man, goes to the Pacific, far from home, sees things that...
Never see again.
Never see again, and thank goodness for that, and that most people never will. And you come back to Hinesville, and you go to the University of Georgia. And so what was... Walk me through some of the rest of your life. You got married?
No, after the University of Georgia, I went to work and at Hinesville Ford Company.
Ford?
Yes, sir.
Cars?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Selling cars? Car dealership?
I don't know what my job was, but I worked there until I retired. And I hate to tell you this, but I didn't retire until 3 years ago. I went to work every day until 3 years ago.
Really?
Yes, sir.
You must have enjoyed it.
Well, it got to be a lot of fun to start with, and I enjoyed it. It was in my blood, I guess. I was in the car business.
For like 50 years, right? More than
long
that.
Time, long a lot, time. Much longer than that.
So you worked there from the time after the University of Georgia?
I worked there when I was 8 to 10 years old. I used to carry the mail, sweep up, do what they asked me to do. I worked there as a kid.
So you worked there like 80 years, on and off?
70-something years.
Wow.
Off and on.
Okay. Yeah. And I guess nobody had been there longer than you.
I don't think so.
Yeah. But you did eventually get married.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Because been married 59 years.
Okay. Okay. So you got
three children.
You got married in
1950. I don't know. Don't let's don't do me.
Yeah,
that
don't
way.
Do that. I'm not even doing the math
wife,
real well right
know.
Now. Right.
I have to remember that day. I just celebrated my anniversary. No kidding.
So what day is your anniversary?
The 11th.
11th of July.
Yeah.
Okay. 1960.
That's right.
Yeah. 59 right. years. Okay. I finally got it.
You got it.
Right. Okay. So I know you've been active in the Hinesville American Legion, the Disabled American Veterans Association, Marine Corps Birthday Ball, all that correct?
Yes, sir.
And you you continue to go and participate in events?
Well, when I can, according to where they are, what time of day.
Right. And you are the only remaining World War II veteran at most of these events.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. The question I always want to ask, what do you want people to know about World War II, about what you did? I heard you say, "Well, I'm not a hero. I didn't do anything.
Well,
I just did what I was told."
I
but what do you think people should know about that war?
Well, I don't know. I'm not so concerned about that. What how they feel about that war? I'm concerned about how they feel about America today. That's the thing that bothers me. I mean, if we had a war now, I don't know how many people would join. People aren't patriotic like they used to be, in my opinion.
Mm.
Some are, but a lot aren't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have all kind of factions.
We do.
So what? We can't discuss sex, religion, or politics. We'll all get in trouble.
Well, they used to say that's what you weren't supposed to do that in polite company, right? I should mention that around this table right now, we have veterans of three of America's wars. Chuck Mobley is here. He's a veteran of Vietnam. David Rosenblum is here, who is a veteran of the Afghanistan and Iraq wars. And so it's been a privilege for me to be with all of you, to talk to you about this.
Well, thank you.
I had lots of other questions, but you more or less have answered them. I do notice you're wearing, I want to ask you, you're wearing a Marine Corps pin on
yes.
your lapel. Tell me about that.
Well, I kind of didn't think too much about the Marine Corps for a long time. And about, pardon me, about 8 years ago, a colonel that I went to church with, a Marine, called me one day and said, I got something on you, and he pinned it on me, and he brought me back.
Why didn't you want to think about it?
Well, I think my answer would be, why would I want to think about it? I wouldn't want to think about the war. I don't have any reason to think about the war. It's better off for me to leave the war there.
Well, I think that says it better than I could. Well, at least from one grateful American, thank you for
what
you did.
It was a pleasure to serve my country, and I'm proud that I did.
And you seem to be in remarkable health.
Thank you, sir.
And I wish you many more years
of
good health. And thank you for coming on this podcast and sharing your experiences with all of us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Mr. Mingle.
Thank you, sir.